I want to thank Patty and Tom for reading that beautiful passage for us. And in case you were hearing some of that language and it sounded kind of, you were wondering maybe if it was suggestive or racy, you're right. It is about that. In the ancient Near East, fruit gardens and vineyards are symbols of female sexuality. And so when the male voice in the poem talks about going to the garden and enjoying all of its choice fruits, he isn't just talking about how it's important to have vitamins. We just read sexy poetry in church. It's going to be okay. How many of you have heard of the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon? Yeah, it's also called Canticles sometimes. How many of you have, before today, heard it read in church? Two people, three people. It's not surprising that it's not everyone. I was going to say, if we exclude weddings, it's not preached on a lot in Unitarian Universalist, Christian, or Jewish communities. But what is surprising, maybe, is that actually this didn't always used to be the case. Back in the day, back in the Middle Ages, this short book of poetry, which is in what we call the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, used to be preached on almost the most, a lot. It was commented on and used a lot, even more so in some cases than the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That's kind of remarkable. If you're wondering about why that is, you can hold on to that question. We'll come around to it. But first things first are, why am I preaching about it today, not just why did some people preach on it in the past? I'm asking us to read this today and to talk about sex and sexuality because it is really important. Because healthy sexuality is, in some cases, a matter of life and death. I have done some work facilitating the Our Whole Lives curriculum. I facilitated it for young adults, and I also led a group with any age adults, and did some religious study alongside that. And what that reminded me of, and what I am often reminded of and continue to be heartbroken about, is how so many people in this culture have experienced some kind of brokenness or trauma around sexuality. Maybe it is surviving sexual abuse or assault, or being affected by intimate partner violence, or having shame about sexual orientation, or maybe internalizing the message that the body, or our body in particular, is deeply undesirable. There are a lot of people who have been stigmatized, traumatized, dehumanized, and just generally messed up about sexuality, and that needs to stop. And the church, the religious communities, have a responsibility to help make that stop. But religious communities haven't always helped, right? In fact, I would say that there is a certain amount of guilt borne by religious communities in over the last couple of thousands of years in teaching us messages about sexuality that aren't so healthy. Christian communities in particular, starting from the Middle Ages, have wedged apart and sort of made an opposition out of body and spirit, and taught that bodies are shameful or less than, and that sexual desire is something that has to do with sin and sinfulness. Sex is horrible and terrible, and dirty and gross, and you should save it for the person you love. Right? That's a really awesome, totally unified message. And I think that a lot of Unitarian Universalists, I would suspect, it's sort of messaging like that that alienated us maybe from a Christian tradition that we grew up in, or made us skeptical about being religious in any way, because we know that's not healthy, not a good experience. In fact, and that inflicts like real spiritual damage to people. And that's something that really came home to me in college. I was on one of those getting to know you retreat. It was a retreat for LGBT students in college. And I stood doing one of those deepening, getting to know you exercises where you stand in a circle and you say, there's a list of prompts and you say, step into the circle if you, whatever it was. So step into the circle if you're from the Midwest, and everyone from the Midwest steps in, and that was a lot of people because I went to college in Minnesota. You know, and then if you identify as lesbian, if you identify as bisexual, you know, whatever your identities are, and then they get more personal, more intense. If you're out to your family, if you have conflict with your family because of your sexual orientation or gender identity. And then there was the one which I remember, which was, step into the circle if you think now or you have ever thought that God does not love you because of your sexual orientation or gender identity. And that was so heartbreaking to watch people to step forward, including someone I knew really well, a good friend of mine, and I knew that she had struggled with depression and conflict with her family, but we'd never had the conversation. I didn't know the spiritual wounding that had come with that. So talking about sexuality and healing the rift that has been created between being a good spiritual person and being a sexual person is really important. And it's important, so that's why I'm talking about sexuality. That's why I'm having us read sexy poetry in church. Because it's important, it's a matter of life and death. And I will say it's not enough just to not enough to just stop being negative about sexuality. You know what I mean? Sort of stop shaming people and not say anything about it, because when that happens and we leave a vacuum and we don't have a different message to share, that old shame-based narrative just fills right in. I think it's surprising. I grew up Unitarian Universalist and did not have explicit, you know, religious shame-based messaging about it, but you still get it from the culture. You still get it from sort of pop religion. It's a deep brokenness, I think, in society about that. And it's one place that Unitarian Universalism, I think we can embrace our countercultural mission, is to have a new narrative, a new story, maybe to tell old stories in new ways. One of the ways that we do that, of course, is by teaching and facilitating our whole lives curriculum. I am really glad that I was able to facilitate, to take it as a young adult and then facilitate it for other young adults. And it can often sometimes feel like we're out there in the culture war. I don't know if this resonates, but sort of out there in the culture wars alone, going, like Kata said, like, you teach what, where? Like, it's surprising. And I will say, I do want to note that our partners, the United Church of Christ, have been our partners in the Our Whole Lives curriculum since the beginning. So there are some, not maybe as many, UCC churches that do teach OWL. And that's, I'm glad that we've had that partnership. And I had us read the Song of Songs because that is a resource for this new narrative or this old narrative in new ways about a positive message about sexuality. I think it's, and I love, I just find it surprising and delightful, and it makes me giggle that this positive message about sexuality is in the Bible, which is a place where there are, let's face it, some pretty weird and negative messages about sexuality. But we can look at it. You can turn when you get home if you have a Bible, or you can borrow one from me or a friend. Look on the internet and find the Song of Songs. It's in the Hebrew Bible, also called the Old Testament. It's very short. It's right before Isaiah. Just don't miss it. My brain just went on a tangent. My mother was forced to memorize the list of the books of the order of the books of the Bible in Lutheran school. And so she does that sometimes, like spontaneously. It's very weird. So, but if that's not you, I'll tell you, it's right by Isaiah. And it is a short book of poetry. It's maybe one poem or maybe a series of poems. And it is dialogues and songs between a male voice and a female voice, and then there's a chorus of female voices. A lot of it is two lovers praising each other's bodies and celebrating their love for one another, and using lots of really rich ancient Near East imagery to talk about that. It's really fun. There's goats. There's your hair is like a flock of goats, which is to say it's wavy and beautiful. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep that have just been shorn, which is to say their teeth are white. And once you kind of do some digging in that imagery, what I find is that you uncover a vision of sexuality that is remarkably compatible with the Our Whole Lives values and with Unitarian Universalism. So it's a book of the Bible that doesn't say that bodies are shameful. It looks at bodies really with love. There are these long metaphorical, figurative language descriptions of a female body, of a male body. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your body is like fragrances from Lebanon. This is a book of the Bible that doesn't get worked up about gender roles. It doesn't have language of ownership of like the male voice owning the female body. It doesn't get worked up about who does what to whom sexually, and it doesn't. While it is a gendered gendered poem, there's a male voice and a female voice. Many of the times, you could drop the pronouns and not know what the gender was happening. And for that reason, and for a couple of other reasons, another reason I like it is it's remarkably easy to climb inside the poem, for a same-sex couple, even as a lesbian, even as a gay person. If you change a couple of the pronouns, you know, I come to my love's garden and eat of all of her choice fruits. It works very well. The other thing, and actually for that reason, and many scholars have seen a sort of liberating positive view for lesbian, gay, and bisexual people in the poem, because it's not super gendered. And there's indications, despite some sort of traditional interpretations, that this is about King Solomon. It really seems more like this is a poem. In the world of the poem, this couple is not married, They're not allowed to be together. They're not allowed to tell their families that they're together. And so that is something that has resonated with same-sex couples in more recent years. I will say that there is language in the reading we heard, my sister, my bride, and that's people sort of think, oh, it's a bride, it's a wedding poem. And it's, I trust my professor of Hebrew Bible when he tells me that those are both sort of non-literal terms of endearment, like baby. So neither of those is literal. All right, where did we go? So it's surprising to me to find such a, I would say it's a remarkably progressive, contemporary, feminist view of sexuality, you know, ancient Near Eastern metaphors aside. It's a language of mutual invitation and mutual desire. In the Our Whole Lives curriculum, we teach that healthy sexual relationships are, among other things, consensual, non-exploitative, mutually pleasurable, and based on mutual expectations and caring. Hear how many times the word mutual appears there. And in the Song of Songs, we hear some of that as well. We hear both the male voice and the female voice make an invitation. The man at the beginning of the poem tells the woman, "Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away." You may have heard that text. And later, we hear an invitation from the female voice. "Come, let us go to the field. There I will give my love to you." They both invite each other. There are a number of refrains in the poem that appear several times that I also think are remarkably progressive, one is, "Do not awaken love until it is ready." So there's a sense of being thoughtful and careful about sexuality. That repeats several times. And the other one is the female voice saying, "I am my love's and he is mine." And that repeats three times. So it's a mutual desire. So much for the Song of Songs being about human sexuality. There's pretty much indications that that's probably what it was about in its original context. There were this type of poetry was happening, and it might have been sung actually at a gathering, a dinner. Someone would have come and sung it. But it's in the Bible. And I think that makes a powerful statement that human sexuality is a religious topic. And it has a vision that is positive in all of these things we've talked about. So much for that. Why have we stuck with it? Why did medieval commentators, remember that question you have in your pocket from the beginning? Why was it commented on and read and preached on so much in the Middle Ages and over the years? And that is, as you may have been told, there's a traditional interpretation that the Song of Songs is an allegory, that is a song of love between God and God's people, or between people, between the church and God, between Christ and the soul, depending on what community you're in. And there's sort of this tendency, we talked about this in a seminar I took in college, there's sort of a tendency for more modern, scholarly, historical, critical, maybe Unitarian, religious liberal types to think this kind of allegorical interpretation is pretty silly. Or that the medieval monks just, were kind of sublimating their sexuality in a way that was silly and not healthy. And you can watch as historical criticism and research has sort of uncovered the hypothesis that this was a secular love poem. And you can watch denominations that sort of start to explore that all of a sudden stop reading it because it's embarrassing and we don't want to talk about it. And sort of decide, well, this allegorical interpretation isn't acceptable or isn't valid if that's not what it was about originally. And I want to challenge that a little bit. I think it is, I think it's interesting. I think it's powerful and novel in religiously liberal communities to think of, to use the image of relationship to talk about our search for meaning. It may be sort of more traditional in some communities to talk about God as a parent or to talk about God as a friend. And this image of God as the beloved is very rich, I think. One reason that it's brings some richness, I will say, is it's the idea that our search for meaning can be full of joy and pleasure and not sort of this thing that's on the to-do list, like, you know, pick up the kids, get the groceries, find truth and meaning, you know, do something else, and that this is a an ongoing and joyful experience. And the other thing that I love about the poem is that when you do that allegorical reading, as I've said, it's a poem of mutual longing. I don't know about you, but sometimes the search for meaning, the prayer, meditation can seem like sort of, is someone there? It feels like it's all my responsibility to figure it out. And if you read it, if you look at the Song of Songs, there's this idea that God is also reaching out to people, or that that there is some greater force than ourselves that is also longing to meet us. And that that recasts that idea of spiritual life. Love is powerful stuff. And for human beings, love includes sexuality, relationship, romance, desire. And so those are important images and to think about and to use. And it's important that we keep celebrating and talking about and creating a new narrative about sexuality that is consistent with our values. And I think we can take courage knowing that we're not doing it alone, that we have some ancient resources, some modern resources in our curricula that we teach. And the idea, we can also take refuge, I think, in the idea that the search for spiritual truth can be like a relationship, ongoing, with back and forth, and full of excitement and longing and love. And that's my hope for us.